code synthesis. That is the thing that we wanted to do all the time since we left constructing the syntax tree. So what is the idea that we follow here? The idea is that we think of ways to translate all the little pieces. We want to generate small instructions for very basic parts of our input file, and use the syntactic information, the syntax tree, as a means of gluing those small parts together in sort of prepared templates that vary from each type of syntax tree to another. So, what we do is we generate code according to the actual type of the subtree that we are in at that position, and we use the code that has been produced for the subtrees of that particular tree to assemble a larger fraction of code, which we then can give to our root and propagate until we reach the top the top node of the complete tree. So that is the actual idea. In principle, that fits quite well into this scheme of having attribute grammars and having the generated code for a specific subtree in the attribute and in the attribute equality system encode the actual rules how to assemble the code for the current subtree. Yeah, what we need for that is, for once, of course, information about the source language which we want to translate in order to get the semantics of what was meant to be expressed with a certain thing. And of course, we need the semantics of the machine that we want to translate to in order to decide how we can actually achieve a certain effect on the hardware that is to be used on the target machine. So for our purposes, since there's a lot of hassles with practical architectures and a lot of details which are simply just not nice to treat on slides, but require to use a lot of hacks, we will continue with introducing a very basic notion of a machine, in this case a virtual machine. There won't be hardware which is actually capable of running that. However, it's quite near to actual machine code, so it's pretty easy to write a small simulator for that. And yeah, maybe it's even quite easy to translate our virtual machine into a concrete assembler. There are a few who are not so far from our syntax as you might expect. So what we introduce here is a little bit different than the thing that you've seen in the virtual machines lecture, if you have attended to that. We will call it the register C machine. C machine because it's crafted to be a kind of ideal target system for a C-like language, and register because we will have a register-based computation model instead of the stack-based computation model that you have on other machines. So what we'll do here is register machine code. There's a few particular things about our register C machine due to lack of space and lack of time and just those practical issues that we don't want to go too much on about. So what you've already heard is that that is not a concrete hardware, so we cannot directly execute it. We can only interpret that. What we have, nevertheless, is we have implemented. Oh yes, once again, we have implemented this RCMA thing as an emulator in our visualization toolkit that you maybe know from Virtual Machines, which is this VAM. You can get that from our homepage. So it is this VAM. If you would like to test things from the slides or from the tutorials. So there you can see how this machine actually works. On KVAT, if you want to have a full C functionality, you won't be able to use something like the RCMA because, well, there we made life easy and said that all the data that we handle in the machine is, for once, it's integers. It's even integers without any different width, so it's just one standardized width, and we don't have any other types than that. So say goodbye to doubles, floats, your favorite character encoding, and even long integers, short integers, or any thing like that. The constructions that we'll do in there will also be valid for these types, of course, but you have to extend the schemes that I will present you in the next slides a little bit in order to get that to run. You also need to, of course, to extend the machine model, but, well, if you know how to translate an add instruction for integers, I'm sure that you'll be able to find a code generation for add for doubles. So, yeah, through that, we'll only handle integers. Yeah, what we also keep our fingers from is any cooperation with the operating system. It's just not a thing that is kind of general in any way. That depends, of course, on your operating system, and that's more a thing of generating predefined or well-known function names and some way of providing a standard library for that. And I think it's not so much about generating code than providing a runtime library. So we don't do that. And maybe the thing that might bother you the most is that instead of dealing with the 32 or 64 registers that are actually accessible in well-known systems, what we will have is an unlimited supply of registers. That sounds like making the problem a lot easier, and it actually is, of course, a lot easier on the design phase, but it's actually not that far from the machine as you think. You can kind of separate the concern of mapping your unlimited number of registers to a combination of memory and a finite number of actual present registers and be completely fine with that. And you can modularize that in another phase and consider that as being a separate problem for which you might also find suitable algorithms. So that's our deal. The restrictions, we have already talked about that. There's a way to lift them away, or they might not be any restrictions at all. There's even practical virtual machine codes that handle things quite similarly. For example, I don't know, has anyone of you already looked into LLVM? Maybe that direction somewhere? Yeah, so you might have noticed that there's this notion of this the just numbered variables that you can use throughout your code. Well, that's obviously not bounded in the LLVM by any small number, at least. So, that's your unlimited register machine for once. The other thing is that, for example, in Java-based languages, it's most of the virtual machines are stack-based. However, there's also a approaches to the Java Virtual Machine where people have used register-based abstractions. And one of the famous ones for that is maybe Dalvik VM. I don't know if anyone knows Dalvik. What is that? So that is one of the many approaches that the Android engineers have done on finding an efficient virtual machine for Java on their handsets. And yeah, one notion of that is the Dalvik VM, where they have moved away from stack-based representation of a machine to a register-based translation scheme. So, yeah, those are machines that have certain similarities to our RCMA standard. Okay. So, what is necessary to specify such a machine? There's a few components for that. Of course, what you need to know about is the instructions that are valid in such machines. And the other part is, of course, the virtual hardware. What is the actual concept that you are modifying with these instructions. This virtual hardware is a thing that we represent by certain data structures that are meant to be modified with the instructions that we provide in our instruction set. And what we often combine with that is also the interpreter, especially if we do that in a virtual machine, that interprets the instructions on data structures that are meant to represent the virtual hardware. So in terms of what is the virtual hardware for our machine, we have certain components, like, for example, start with this S thing. The S stands for store and is meant to be the data store. It's a memory region which is used to back up certain information depending on your current call. And when you do subroutine call, you will back up your current information onto the stack, and when that call returns, you'll be able to restore the current state of your machine from that store. So that is what the data store is actually for. It is accessed in a stack based way. So it's a last in, first out data structure. So the last thing that you put on is your own data, so to say, which you want to access, of course, as soon as you start accessing that. So last in, first out is the right data structure for that. In order to manage an area of memory in a stack fashion or last in first out session, what you also need is a stack pointer, which you manage to point to the latest written data. Then there's another component, which we call C. That is also a store, but it's meant to be accessed in order to retrieve runnable code. So it's encodings of instructions that you find on that store. For the purpose of being simple, we choose this code store as well as the data store to have a fixed width of each element that is put on there, so we don't have to hassle with different sizes of or widths of your data structures. You always access one piece of information at one index with a granularity of 1. So that's it. So the instructions all fit into one slot each. There's a program counter, which manages the actual position, or, well, better, we should say, which manages a pointer to the next instruction to be executed. And the thing is that for our purposes, well, we're not gonna profit from rewriting the code that we are actually executing at that particular moment. So for us, it's completely sufficient that the code memory is initialized at program load time and remains read-only thereafter. So, yeah, we assume the whole thing to be read-only. Yeah, the program counter is the thing that we said is managing or points to the instruction to be executed next. And in the beginning, well, we start with index 0 in there. Apart from that, what we also need is this interpretation loop. So that is the main thing that keeps the interpretation running. The basic idea for that is that this thing accesses the code store and retrieves the next instruction and interprets that. For that, it's just an infinite loop where we have we actually access the code store at the index of the to be executed next instruction, retrieve that into this IR thing, then we point our code pointer to just the next instruction and start executing the whole thing. That is done by calling the interpreter function itself on the next to be interpreted instruction. Okay, so that has a certain model in mind. You might wonder why we do something like this, where we increment the program counter somewhere right in the middle of the loop. Well, the main thing that we have to be aware of is that we need to be able to somehow alter control flow at certain instructions. There's instructions that do branching or looping, and all of them somehow modify the control flow. So they need to be able to communicate to the following execution of the loop body where the program counter points to. So it's just no use to increase the old program counter somewhere here, because we might want to set the program counter to some specific static or dynamically determined value. So in these cases, we need to override the program counter and be sure that it won't get incremented afterwards, so that's why we do that beforehand. Okay, you might wonder when that whole execution actually stops, and well, it's meant not to be stopped at all, except for if you have in the input something like a hold instruction, which is something like the system exit or an exit in C or something. That would mean that the whole interpreter can go down. And yeah, either you do that with an exit instruction in your interpreter, or you need to manipulate some flag instead of having this true over here, which where you would set this flag within the execute somewhere. So that would be the general design of your interpreter. Let's talk about the concrete instructions. And while we talk about the instruction semantics, we also have a look at the corresponding parts of the syntax tree that actually trigger the use of that particular instruction. So it's all about generation of code for one way to start with code generation with C-like languages is to have a look at the way that expressions are generated from the source code. So we do so by looking at an example expression, which is this 1 plus 7 times 3. And the goal for that particular thing for generating code for expressions is to actually evaluate this expression and make the result somehow accessible to the context in which this expression is actually used. May it be some kind of other expression or some other parts where it connects to statements or something. So the idea is to go through the whole thing by computing values for the sub-expressions and storing the intermediate result in a temporary register that is, although it's temporary, it is a well-known place for the directly surrounding syntax element, may it be an expression or a statement. And apply the operator in loop is it's maybe not to be seen as a sequence. If you are inside such an expression, what you would do is you would use such a temporary register to retrieve that value and apply another operator on that temporary register and store its result in yet another temporary register that you hand on to the next phase. So yeah, that's what this loop should actually mean. For the purposes of the register schema, what we therefore need is some way of saying what is a valid register. And for us, we say let's assume that we have the need for two kinds of registers in our translation. For once, we need some place to that we can use for the evaluation of actual expressions. This would be meant to be, of course, registers that are used only in a local scope. We don't need to communicate via these registers to some other areas in the code. So this is simply for computing values of expressions. And in case that we somehow need to transfer information from our currently valid function instance to something else, we would refer to other register sets, which are these global registers. And yeah, that is what we need these two register sets for. So instead of just the plain code memory or code store and data store, we now also manage the local registers and the global registers. These are two, that's kind of an artificial division between them. What you see is that we consider all the construct. Well, I baptize that that thing that you see here, a constructor. So it's an R with a number in the index, and if this index is positive, I consider that thing as a local register. If you use this R with something else in the index, especially the zero, and of course all the negative numbers, then we consider these registers as global. Of course, that's kind of an artificial assignment of globality and locality, but it's kind of conventions that we introduce throughout our complete code generation scheme, and we will use them in a way that that will be consistent, so that everything fits together. So you have to decide on something like that. Good. So the locals are now the positives, and globals are the non-positives. Yeah. For that, what do we use the local registers for? Of course, we said the primary use is to save the temporary results while evaluating complicated expressions. Also, another purpose that I haven't told you about so far is that we would use the local registers not only local to one statement only, but local for with respect to body of a function. In the sense that we also use the local variables as means of storing the actual parameters for a function. So that is the second purpose for local variables or local registers. So it's local variables of a function that we put in there. And what we also provide is that there's an instruction that performs all the necessary storing and restoring of these register values to our stack and back to our register set. So that is also something that we assume to be given. The local registers serve a quite different purpose. We need those to communicate between caller and callee, for example. But what we need to communicate is, for example, the parameters of the function. So a function has a set or a list of formal parameters, and they need to be filled in with actual parameters at or shortly before the function is called. And that is something that we do with the global registers. And the other thing is, as soon as this function terminates, we find the result of the function being given also in the global registers, specifically in register zero. We will see a little bit later on, but yeah, that's why the zero is part of our global registers. So yeah, we store the result of the function in there. And of course, there's something like global variables for which we also need some space. So we will also place them in global registers. Okay, so for the next few slides, we will probably only need these local registers, but you'll see the others later on. Another convention that we will keep to for keeping book of registers for which might still be useful later on, and registers which are free to be used for evaluation of expressions. Well, we could devise some very complicated scheme with some kind of garbage collector and redistribution of things, but that that might be a very hard thing to do in a static way. So we resort to a very easy thing here. What we'll do is we will use register counter, and we will in this register counter we will keep book of the first register that is not in use or in terms of, well, if you count them starting from one to positive infinity, then all the register numbers that are smaller than I are meant to be in use, and registers that are numbered with I or larger are meant to be available for other computations. We can store values in them. So this register counter is meant to be handed down through the generation of code for the expressions, and as soon as we realize that we need some specific result to be used later on, we will increase this value, of course, and give every evaluation function for a sub-expression a larger number to work on, so that this sub-expression code generation must assume that all the values, including my specific dearest ones that I want to conserve, are in use and are not available for usage. So that is a parameter that will pass down throughout our code generation, or that we expect to be given from our context if we come from bottom to top. So let's do simple expressions. We have talked a lot about these conventions so far. Let's see a few examples. So basic things are maybe constants. Constants are very simple basic expressions, and yeah, what we have as instructions for that is something that we call the load constant, and we have what we will have as parameters for that is, for once, of course, the actual value that we want to use as a constant later on, as well as the register in which we want to this constant to reside for further use later on. Yeah, we might also want to do something with this register value. So there's also another thing. There's a move where we can give a source of the move and a destination of the move. So with that, we will copy the content from register RJ to RI. So what we can take away from that is that we will have the format instruction, then there's the destination, and further there's source, and if there are several of them, we will have something like that. So that is the format that these instructions are going to have. With that, we can already start to introduce a few code generation schemes. So you'll see me setting up a system of function definitions for something that I have baptized code R. Anyone here that has a clue what this R should actually mean? Close. Yeah, that's probably too obvious. No, yeah, please.
It's an R value.
Yeah, that was mean what I was going for. Sorry, that was misleading with the R in that case. Yeah, but it's an R value. You know that from
virtual machines.
So there, that's something that appears there too. That's a common thing that you use when you provide code generation functions for C-like languages. There's this concept of an R value, which is meant to be a value for the purpose of having it on the right side of an assignment operator. And then there's this concept of an L value, which serves as a destination for another value, which can be or is meant to be used for code generation for the left-hand side of an assignment. So there's this thing here. In general, you would probably be interested in the evaluation of a certain expression, and that is the thing that is considered to be the value that is suited for the right-hand side of an assignment, thus code R. So code with underscore R is the specific code generation responsible for evaluation of an expression. So the R is a fixed component. It's not a parameter to the whole thing, but the R is kind of in the naming scheme for the function. Then there's another hidden thing over here, which is this I thing. I was talking about that a little bit earlier. That is our counter in which we count the first register number that is available for temporary code generation, temporary values to be computed in. So all the registers that are smaller than I are already in use. We cannot use them while we provide the code for the expression over here. And but everything that is larger than that we can use for the code generation. So in our case, we will expect that to be given by the context, by the larger expression in which this blue expression over here is the sub-expression of. And yeah, for our purposes, that is a simple expression. It's just the constant. So if we have the constant appearing in our syntax tree, we will use this code R function in that notion here to provide the code that we will actually put into the attribute system and communicate to the rest of the tree. And the code R for a constant will just result in the code fragment over here, which will be a load constant of C in RI. And see here, we use the information that I is the first available register as a clue for that we will generate code that will place the evaluation of the expression that we are working on right in. So what we'll do is we will load the C in the RI, and the context will assume that the evaluation of that subtree will leave its evaluation in the first available register. That is the idea. Okay. So let's move on to the next thing. Next thing that we see is another code R, but this time for something, I've put an X in here. Well, it looks quite similar to the C above, but with C I meant constant. With X I mean a specific variable here. And the code generation for such a variable is, we've said that variables are something that we represent as throughout a function body. We will use local registers to store the values of local variables. So in order to do that, what we do is we will keep an address environment here, where we can look up the register number for all of the declared variables. So that is something that you have to provide, maybe by extending the declaration use analysis with also something that would just enumerate all the variables. And if you do so, you can just obtain the number of or the index for the local variable by querying this address environment, and you can use that then as an accessor to the value of this x. So if the if we need the right hand side value for x, what we will do is we will use a move, because what we so far what we want to do is we want to keep the value of x still intact, even though after we leave the code generation for that x, this what we need is to move the value to this temporary register where it is expected to live and to be accessed by the surrounding enclosing expression or statement. So what we need to do is we need to transfer the value that resides within the register that represents the local variable into the register that is currently available as, or that's primarily available for the evaluation of that sub-expression. So yeah, for that we do a simple move. Then if we want for to evaluate an assignment, what we do is we'll do kind of the reverse thing. If we have a let's say if we have a variable on the left-hand side here, we kind of generate the left-hand side code for that particular variable. And because that is in the register point of view a pretty simple thing, I don't introduce another different notion of the code generation function, but I just do it in a kind of an inline way. So if we encounter the code generation for an assignment expression, x, e is assigned to x, what I will do is I will call the code generation function for e, the expression e that is on the right-hand side, and I, well, now I'll move, well, let's clear away everything so that we can see the actual thing. Red and... We will hand over the counter for the first free register to the generation function for of the sub expression, so that we can use all these registers, and in particular that we store the evaluation of that expression in this specific I, and then we will take this result from the register RI and store it into the permanent store for the local variable. Well, with permanent, of course, I mean permanent as long as the function body lives. Okay, so that is the way that we roll for code generation. At least the parts that we've seen so far with constants and variables. Of course, there's a lot more to expressions than just constants and variables. There's a whole lot of different operations that can be done and can be found in source languages also. So we don't only have assignments, but a whole lot of other operators. And well, so for basic arithmetic purposes, you'll see that there's a whole bunch of them. We have add, sub, diff, multiply, modulo, less, greater, equal, less or equal, greater than equal, and or. So that is just just an excerpt, concrete. Concrete instruction sets have a lot more of these operators to offer, especially as there are different ones for integer arithmetics and floating point arithmetics. So there's these different flavors. Then there's also a lot of options that you can have in these operators. You can specify something like how to handle carries, how to handle division by zeros or whatever. There's a whole lot of options that you can have within these, and you can have special purpose operators for that. But the most basic ones are the ones that we have here. So it's just plain addition, subtraction, and so forth. And for each of them, we provide an instruction in the RSema. Each of them is a binary operator. It works on two parameters. So what the general format is what you see over here. You have the operator and three registers, where the first of them is, of course, the target or destination, and the others are source 1 and source 2. So that is the way they are meant to be read. Yeah, that's what's over there. Yeah, so if we find our expressions in the source tree like that, where we have E1 operator E2, what we'll do is, well, we need for that to work in our virtual machine, we need to be calling at some point to the operator instruction. But for that to work, we also need the evaluation, concrete values which reside in registers somehow. So we need to evaluate the sub-expressions first. So that's what we'll do. And for that, we will rely on code generation for E1 and code generation for E2. And in order to access them in a meaningful way, what we'll do is we'll have the generation for E1 generating the value into register RI, which is the first available one, and the second into I plus 1, which is also an available one, although now we have our convention is that when we call code generation, just a moment, when we call code generation, we will generate into the first free or first available register, the one with the lowest number. So we will be sure to find our results in RI and RI plus 1. And then what we'll do is we'll recycle the register RI for our result and let that be the destination for the whole operation. You'll be, you will wondering. You're referring to the thing that with that we have some kind of interference between the at least possibly accessed or written to registers. Well, the code generation for E1 and code generation for E2 may use the same registers. That's for sure. There's no restrictions that keeps them from reusing. The only thing is that within the code generation for E1, we might, of course, use a whole lot of registers. If there's sub-expressions, then there's even more than just two or three used. However, the thing is that as soon as the code generation is done, we say that, well, on the set of local registers, we mainly do these temporary computations. So the purpose for having these registers was to have a temporary place to store them. And in the end, what only matters is kind of the evaluation of the sub-expression. For if you think back, we had this convention that we only need a size of 1 for each of the data items. So that is the motivation for having these indices I and I plus 1. So with I plus one as the first available register, we will never come into the problem of overwriting I, at least if we keep to our conventions. And thus the evaluation of the sub-expression for E1 will survive. And yeah, if you kind of think for parallelization, of course you're screwed. That's with that that wouldn't work anymore. But if you do that in the sequence, then everything's fine.
Where does the bookkeeping for the register pointer take place? Do we just leave that out for simplicity, or is that completely other?
You can well. It's actually happening here. So you can consider that thing to be an additional parameter. I've just written it as a in a different way than this E1 and E2. But you can also just move that down as another parameter in there. Yeah, it's here.
Otherwise, we'd be using register one.
Yeah, so that's happening here. So, what you see here is the thing that's happening during the code generation phase. So you will realize this thing throughout the attribute grammar, or maybe even in a recursive function or a visitor thing. And this I thing is a inherited attribute. You start off with having no local variable used at all, with zero, and you propagate through your tree, and it's an L attribute, so it's not directly the same as this as the code generation. You would have to either code the whole thing as a recursive function on the function tree while descending. You do the bookkeeping and addition and all that. While getting back up, you do the construction of the code pieces. Or you might see that as different attributes, where this I thing is something that you do in one phase. And in the code generation phase, you would only access this I as a concrete value then. So, yeah, the way that you see it presented here is the way that you would see if you do that as a recursive function. So this code generation thing would be a recursive function starting on the root and managing this I while calling and while performing the body of the code generation functions, you would do the assembly of the code fractions. Yeah, but it's a valid question, and this is something that you kind of need to be aware of. These things are happening during code generation phase. During code generation, you can determine the number of registers that you're using at that moment, and during actual execution, these things will be inlined. There will be concrete values in the R's, so that in the end, there's a concrete number landing there. But we'll see a concrete example, I think, right now. So, yeah, that is the. Maybe a little bit more enlightening. So translating this r time 3 times 4, for example, is the expression. So we'll find the expression over here. And now you see that I've given you a concrete number for this I. This is the one that you get if you reach that particular context where you want to evaluate 3 times 4 in your syntax tree, and you have determined this the number of local variables already, and they maybe are there are 3 of them or so. So the first available local variable for evaluation is 4, and Thus, the whole thing will end up with having I as 4 in there. So there's already the concrete number in there. And all we need to do now is we need to generate code for this sub-expression 3 times 4, which will, well, we have seen for an operation. What we do is we will, in the end, come up with the multiplication of a few values which we expect to be residing in certain registers, namely R4 and R5. But for them to be there, we need to trigger an evaluation with 4 as the first free register and 5 as the first available register. And we should also probably give the sub-expressions to evaluate as parameters in there. And the address environment remains always the same. So, yeah, address environment is carried through. Good. So what will the code functions for R, code functions for 3 and for 4 actually return? Well, there's this load constant thing, so we will end up with having load constant R4, 3 and load constant R5, 4, and in the end we'll do the multiplication into register 4. So that's how the whole system works. Yeah. This we have talked about reusing these temporary registers. There is a more longish example over here, which should illustrate that we will, throughout the evaluation of a more complex expression, we will reuse these registers as soon as we don't need them anymore. So for that, we set up a few things. There's this rather complicated expression like that, where we have 3 times 4 plus 3 times 4, so there's a lot of operations involved there. However, we can split up the code generation by, when we look at, for example, the outermost operator, which is this addition or plus, and we say we'll take the first available register 4 here and generate our result in there and expect our operands to reside in R4 itself, of course, for reusage, and in R5, the next one, and trigger the generation of evaluation code into register 4 and 5 by giving these values to the code generation functions. And as it's all the time 3 times 4, I'll only give you one time how this looks like. So 3 times 4 is what we've seen on the last slide. So it's just load constants for 3 and for 4. We have also seen that the indices will be I and I plus 1, and the result will end up being in I, or register RI. So these are the basic blocks for that. Now, if we put them together, what you'll see is that there's a lot of reusage of variables there. So this R4, in which we carry out the complete evaluation, will be handed over, of course, to this method, where we will use it for the intermediate result, but also for loading the 3. So there's a whole lot of usages for this 4. The 5, for example, we will also give as the place to generate our evaluation into, and thus it will also be used for the intermediate result here and for the loading of the constant. However, it will also be used in the previous instance of our evaluation for loading constant 4 in there. So there's really a lot of reusage, and you'll see that happening over here. So we have R4 quite a lot of times, but even more, we also have R5 very many times. So there's R5 as a parameter here. It reappears as intermediate result here. We have that also as the place where the constant lives, but also where the second parameter to the first multiplication goes. So, yeah, it's kind of, well, they're used kind of similarly often. But, oh, I missed this one. Okay, so the R5 is used even more often than R4 in that context. But that's the reusage pattern that we see here. Yeah, similarly to just add and assign, there's a whole lot of other operators out there. Here we have the binary ones. These are quite common and could be expected to be like that. So I think you probably have given the same definitions as you would find over here anyway. The modulo operator is just it's doing what you expect for it to do. Just the only thing is that it's ignoring the sign of the actual value. So we're working on just without any signs in there. Okay, then the other ones that we find over here are the ones that are dealing with the numbers as containers for Boolean expressions in the way that C does it. So if we do that, we can also interpret comparison operators on our integers. And yeah, what we'll see is that if we do, for example, a less than operation on rj and rk, what will come out of that is that if rj is actually smaller than rk, we will find that ry is 1. So true, so to say, and if it is not the case, then we will find 0 less. So 0 encodes false, and exactly 1 encodes true. That might differ to what you have in some other concrete implementations, but it's just a convention here, and yeah, you might have other systems where it's not just 1 that encodes true, but all other values that are different from 0. But yeah, it's just a matter of some implementations of compilers wanting to optimize the actual computation of such a comparison, and it actually doesn't matter too much how it's implemented in reality. And with that scheme, you can have all the comparison operators in that fashion. So there's less than, greater than, equality test. There's lesser or equal. There's greater or equal. Yeah, and then of course there's the bitwise and bitwise OR, and they're just mapped to bitwise and then bitwise OR. So yeah, nothing too fancy here. Yeah, so there's also another thing, that's the unary operators. There might be more, of course, but the ones that are the classics are negation or not, and yeah, what you have there is you have just one parameter for the code fragment, and you will trigger the code generation for that particular sub-expression, and then perform the instruction and have the register as its own target, and yeah, you'll just overwrite what you have computed so far, and with that, you will reuse that register. That's our way of saving register space. Yeah, That's just the example from -4. That's an it's a unary operator, and what you have to do is you have to provide a code for just the 4, and what you'll do then is you'll do the negate and have the result like that, and in the end this will turn out to be like that. No big wonder. Yeah, that's the semantics for the whole thing. So not has to be this special way of you have to look out for 0 and then produce 1. In every other case, we will produce 0. Okay, and for the arithmetic negation, you will just do what the arithmetics will tell you. So, yeah, it's not too difficult. So, let's have that in a little bit of different example, where we have a complete environment given. We map X, Y, and Z as local variables. So that's what is given to us by this definition use analysis. When we see that there's declarations of variables, then we will have an environment where we can query that the value of or the address of X will be 1 in terms of local registers. The address of Y is 2, and the address of Z is 3. So that is given by the phase before in the address environment. And the free register thus needs to be larger than all the local variables that we've found so far. So R4 is the sane decision for that. That saves us a lot of registers to be used later on. So I is 4. Thus, for code generation, we will have 4 as the index for the first free local variable. Code itself is, well, that is the thing that we will use later on for statement translation, so it misses the index R right now. What we do here is the expression statement. So what we will, what I have omitted here is the actual step from the code generation function code without anything to the code R. So that should probably be in the middle somewhere. So maybe it should have been like code I of that thing together with our address environment is, and then we go over to code R because we'll need to have the right-hand side code generation scheme for that expression. Remember, assignment itself is also an expression, so we'll need to go over to the code R function for that thing. And yeah, for that to work, we need to call this move R1, R4. I think you have seen that thing already a few slides past. And we have the evaluation of Y plus Z plus 3 then, once again in the code R manner. And that will, for that code generation from over here, we will see how that works out. That will be an addition because that binds better than the rest. So the addition is the thing that's going to be triggered here with the results in R4 and R5. R4 is just that is a local variable, or that needs to be the local variable, that needs to be Y. So let's have a look at how we come to the value of Y, and we'll see Y is an entry, a valid entry in our environment. It maps to 2, so we find the value, the current value of Y in our environment, in local register 2, So that's what we will use as the source for our move here, and we'll move it into R4. And the other thing is that we, of course, need the evaluation of set times 3. So it's like here. As we have an intermediate result in R4 already, what we need to do is we need to generate into 5. So that's going over here. And this is, well, bog standard. We have once again a variable. So that thing we look up in there. Take this index as the index of the local register, move it into our intermediate register, generate the code for 3 in register 6, and perform the actual multiplication on that thing. Yeah, and that's the load constant for the 3. And with that, we have everything that we need, and we just have to perform inlining. So we do this in here, we do with this in here, and we'll do this in here. And with that, we'll get the sequence for the complete assignment like this. So it's just inlining all the results. Good. Let's move on. We've done a lot of things for expressions and evaluation of expressions so far. Let's do a few things that actually work a little bit different than just plain computation of results. What you've seen already in use on the slide before was that I have a differentiation in the naming scheme of code generation for expressions and statements. And this differentiation is, well, of course, like all the time, is through this small r. And this differentiates between the code generations for expressions and for statements. So now we're concentrating on the code generation for the kind of larger things, these statements. Statements are kind of on another level than these expression productions were in terms of grammar rules and all that. What we still keep, however, is the management of free temporary registers. These are still managed via this I parameter. So, that is what we had as the code generation scheme for the assignment expression. Note that in the representation of the actual thing to translate for the expression, we have just x. E is assigned to x without anything else. As soon as we add a semicolon to the end, the whole thing now turns into another group of productions, and that is the expression statement, which is part of these statement productions. And for that, we switch over to the code generation thing, and that's the thing that you've seen me add to the last slide already. The point where we start to deconstruct the assignment expression or the expression statement and remove the statement part with a semicolon and go on with translating the inner expression is the moment where we switch over from using the plain code generation function to the code R generation function. So that is where we switch over from the names. It's just kind of a marker that that kind of helps you to keep your code clean, so to say. So, apart from that, what do we have to consider with that? Well, if we are already done with evaluating the actual expression from an expression statement and now have to do the semantic actions for the expression statement, there's simply nothing to add anymore. All the things that actually made some kind of difference were already done during the phase where we have treated the expression itself. You might argue that for an assignment expression, there is actually something happening. There is an effect of that. And it would be saving the result of the right-hand side expression into the left-hand side expression. But that is something which is already done during the code generation of the expression as a kind of a side effect. And that's what you have already seen happening here. So the an assignment has its effect already during the evaluation of the expression part of the whole thing. That's why you can have these kind of nested assignments with several assignment operators, one after each other. That's exactly what's happening here. You have an assignment as a right-hand side value of another assignment, and so on. And that works by communicating through these available registers and the moves to the actual targets of each particular assignment as a side effect of evaluation of that expression. So in the end, there remains nothing to do for an expression statement, and we can just the only thing that we need to do is we have to switch over from code to code R. Okay, that's what I've already said. Within the bodies of functions, we have statements appearing not in isolation but as sequences of statements. So what we have there is usually a list of statements, like that, with S being a single statement and SS being the rest of the list, or even empty if there is nothing anymore. And what we do is we just split into the code generation of the first statement and code generation of the rest. Of course, that depends on how you have represented your statement sequences in your syntax tree and in your grammar. You might switch around these two if you have constructed your lists the other way around, but let's just each of them is fine. And in the end, with the empty sequence, you just do no code generation anymore. So let's talk about altering the control flows, maybe at least introducing that a little bit. For now, all we have done is we have generated codes for for expressions where we could follow just a linear sequence of expressions, and we have generated or seen how we can generate sequences of statements, but there was just no variation in control flow whatsoever apart from following the sequence that was given before. Now we have source code constructs that actually diverge from that by having a workflow which is not a workflow, an interpretation which is not linear anymore, but you may want to somehow differentiate the code that you want to execute depending on certain conditions. For that purpose, we introduce means of manipulating the control flow, and that's what we call the jumps. So that's the next concept. A jump is a different kind of instruction that we introduce in our RCMA, and it will work like just an instruction and a label. And this label is meant to be somehow associated with an index in the code store, thus can be used as a value that we can transfer to the program counter. So when we encounter such a jump A, what we'll do or what we'll get is we will have a value in the program counter before, but after we execute or when we interpret that instruction, what we'll do is we will assign the label to the actual program counter, and afterwards we can find that value in the program counter. This will lead the interpretation loop that we have seen, this while thing which was accessing the program counter, this will lead the this loop to, when it repeats its body, use this program counter with the new offset into the code store, and thus will alter the flow of our program. And as a plain jump is probably not giving you a lot of expressivity, you need some way to do that depending on data, of course, because that's the most interesting part. So conditional jumps, is it? They work pretty similar to the static jump, except that they will have another parameter. So what we know so far is that we have a jump instruction. This time it has another suffix, the Z for zero, and it still has the potential target where we want the control flow to be redirected to. But now what we also have is a new parameter RI. This is from the local registers. And the semantics will be that this RI will be queried. We'll have a look at that. And in case the evaluation, or well, the value within this RI is actually zero, well, it's different from zero, then, jump zero will probably not like that and leave everything in order, and we'll just do the follow-through semantics, and this will lead to the next iteration of the interpretation loop to use the next instruction that it has been provided with anyway. So there's nothing happening over here. This remains the value that it had been before. The more interesting case is then the one where we actually have a zero in the register RI. In that case, what we'll do is we'll leave the RI alone, of course. But now we'll see that index A is then transferred to the program counter, which will lead to a jump in case that the value of RI was zero. So that's what the pseudocode over here gives us. Yeah, that's kind of the hardware feature that will help us with performing control flow manipulation. There's a few ways of making use of that in terms of syntactic constructs. For example, the one that we all know and love is the if operator. So if we encounter a statement that has if and a condition as well as a sequence of statements, I forgot the brackets over here, but yeah, that's something that I haven't. Yes, please.
Where it is jumping to. If it is a value, it would be something that would need to be determined later on, as we don't know what is the block that comes in between the jump and the A, and then maybe it might break our evaluation graph, that it might get cyclic.
For our purposes, we would like to have that as a unique character sequence or something. Unique throughout the complete code, and there needs to be another phase where we assign for each of these things a fixed number.
Yeah. So you can't evaluate this in one go.
Yeah, so there's a kind of an intermediate code that you give out there, and you need to have a symbolic interpreter for labels in the interpreter, or have another phase where you replace that with concrete indices into the code store. So, yeah.
So this would be an example where there was an exercise in the last tutorial practice exercise where we showed that if a machine has can be evaluated in depth first search, and this I think would evaluate exactly this. And because of this, we need another pass through this to evaluate
the. I think you can have quite smart. Routines to do that in one run already, where as soon as you mention such a encounter a label in the intermediate code somewhere, or try to create such a label, and if it doesn't exist so far, it will create a new unique identifier for that. And use that from now on. Register that as similar as a declaration of a variable name, for example. And with that, you would only need an interpreter, which somehow associates the whole thing with an index in the code function. That would be probably sufficient. Anyway, that's already deep into the implementation of that. But yeah, that might be some place where it looks nicer than it actually is. Okay. Yeah. As you can imagine, what you would use this jump 0 for is these if statements. And yeah, what you have there is you have a condition for which you need to trigger the evaluation in a well-known place called I. Over here, for that you can use that now as the source for the conditional jump. And in case you have the value of false there, you would not interpret the statements that come in the statement sequence after the condition, and you would directly jump to A, and by that you would jump over the code generation for this state sequence. If not, then you can directly continue with the body of the if, and that will lead to the code generation for the statement list or statement sequence of the body of if. So with that, you have a rough idea how you can use these jumps to perform data flow manipulation. We will continue next time with a few more elaborate ones, and also with interprocedural things like calling functions, returning from functions, and kind of completing the picture with the main function and all that. So, so far, so good. I think that's a good point to break. Thank you for your attention, and have a nice week.